Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. Every so often, a story comes along and makes you want to change your life. So, fair warning, the following episode may lead you to quit your day job and go on the hunt for a parcel of land to rewild yourself. So, should Smarty Pants go the way of the mammoth or the auroch, you'll know where I am. So what is rewilding? As Isabella Tree explains in her new book, Wilding, it's a way of managing land for conservation that involves minimal human intervention. Think of the National Park Service approach to Yellowstone, for example, or the reintroduction of wolves and beavers and bison in the West. Human hands off, animal hoofs and claws on. NEP Wildland, Isabella Tree and Charlie Burrell's former farm in West Sussex, is a 3,500-acre experiment in radical conservation that challenges conventional ideas about what our land should look like in the future and what it's looked like in the past. Fallow deer, Exmoor ponies, longhorn cattle, and Tamworth pigs now roam the English countryside, trampling through scrubland and tearing down tree branches. And alongside these growing populations of grazing animals, other species have exploded. Endangered ones like the turtle dove, the peregrine falcon, rare butterflies. NEP is pointing the way towards a wilder, richer future, like the one you're hearing behind my voice right now, Birdsong from NEP. Isabella Tree joins us from London to talk about her wild experiment. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Great pleasure.
So can you set the stage for the transformation of NEP from a working farm to what it is now? I mean, what made you shift gears so dramatically?
Well, we inherited this farm. It's 3,500 acres in a corner of southeast England in West Sussex from my husband's grandparents in the 1980s. And already when we inherited, it was a failing farm. It's arable and dairy. Every inch of it had been ploughed up since the Second World War, and it had been continuing to be worked like that. We sort of assumed, I think, when we took over with the sort of naivety and optimism of youth, that we could make a go of it. And for 17 years, we did what all good farmers are supposed to do. We intensified, we bought bigger machinery, we changed our types of cattle so that they could produce more milk. We sprayed the land with more fertilizers, more pesticides, more fungicides, you name it, threw all these chemicals at the land. And after 17 years, in fact, our overdraft was rising. And the reason was that we're on very heavy clay. It's marginal land. It was never really cut out for intensive farming. And as technology has got more sophisticated and bigger farms are more successful, we just could not compete. I think the realization hit us in about 2000, and we decided to sell up the farm machinery and sell all the animals, made our farm manager redundant and 9 men. It was a very black day. But we knew that we wanted to continue managing the farm. It was no option for us to sell. This had been in my husband's family for over 200 years. And we thought we would do something with the land rather than working against it all the time. And just by complete coincidence, I think, the timing was extraordinary. In 2000, this remarkable man called Franz Vera had brought out a book called Grazing Ecology and Forest History in English. it's not the lightest read. But what basically he's saying was really sending shockwaves through the conservation and ecology community at the time. Because what he's saying is that in all our imaginings of how our landscape in temperate zone Europe and in Britain would have looked, we've completely forgotten about the huge herds of roaming animals that would have been here. We've forgotten about bison, auroch, tarpan, elk, wild boar, beavers by the million. And so what he's saying is that these animals drive habitats. They create wonderful mosaics of sort of margins and vegetation complexity. And if you want to recover some of the huge biodiversity losses that we've been suffering over the last few decades, or maybe a century or more, you can do this by reintroducing these herds of animals and allowing them to roam about the landscape and create habitat. The key is to sit back and let them do it. And so we thought this was really intriguing, and we decided that we would do an experiment. It's now called rewilding, but at the time we weren't really using that word. We ring-fenced our 3,500 acres and released some free-roaming animals, and off we went.
Yeah, Franz Ferrer's thesis about grazing animals totally blew my mind. And what I love about the story of NEP is just how unexpected a lot of the changes were, because no one has really done an experiment like this in England before. And ironically, some of the opposition you got from conservation groups, and as a result, a lack of funding, actually led to the success of the acres that you ignored.
Well, that's absolutely right, because we got some funding. We didn't do it, you know, the whole 3,500 acres in one go. We weren't that brave. We did it sort of by increments, and we got some funding to restore the Repton Park around the house. It's this wonderful Nash Castle. And that we got funding to restore the park, so we released free-roaming fallow and Old English longhorns and Exmoor ponies into that area, and Tamworth pigs eventually. But there was a large chunk of land, about 1,200 acres, that we just couldn't get funding for because it had never been on a map that had been shown to be a park before. And at that time, there was only funding available for park restoration. So we just didn't know what to do with it. And we just left it, basically. It wasn't worth us farming it. It wasn't even worth contract farming. Nobody was interested. We just let it go. And so for about 6 or 7 years, you had this incredible vegetation pulse. We didn't even have the money or the wherewithal to sow grasses or native flora again, like we did in the park restorations. So after ploughing, after the final harvest, we just let it go. And what happened was you suddenly get this explosion of vegetation. You get thorny scrub, blackthorn, bramble, hawthorn, sallow, all sorts of vegetation coming up. And then finally, when 7 or 8 years later, we'd been able to persuade the powers that be to give us funding for this experiment and ring fence it and let animals into this area, we already had some exciting vegetation there. So what you have is a much more equal battle between vegetation succession and animal disturbance. So you've got the herds of animals free roaming in this scrubland that now looks much like Africa, really like the African bush. It's astonishing. And it's constantly moving. It's very dynamic. And the animals there are creating ever more complex vegetation structures. The vegetation is fighting back because the shrubs, as they're browsed by, because the cattle obviously browse as well as graze, they produce sharper thorns, they produce tannins, so they start fighting back. And this creates endless opportunities for other forms of life. It's just been rocket fuel for biodiversity, and it was by complete accident that we'd done it this way.
Can you explain what the oak tree has to do with all of this? Because the oak is part of this story at the park that you restored, but it also sprouts up, so to speak, in the southern block in the midst of this scrubland.
Yes, I mean, in a way, the oak tree was our epiphany, I think. It began us thinking along this path of restoration because we have a wonderful old oak tree right next to the house. It's about 500 years old. So, you know, it was a sapling in the Wars of the Roses. You know, it would have seen the Civil War and parliamentarians and cavaliers and roundheads riding underneath it. It's an extraordinary piece of history, but it was splitting down the middle. And we got a wonderful man called Ted Green to come and advise us about it. And in short, he said, well, there's actually nothing wrong with this tree. We can stabilise it. It'll be fine for another 500 years. But he turned his back and he looked at these trees in the landscape around us that where we'd been farming, ploughing right up to the roots of the trees, right up to the tree trunks. And he said, now those trees are in trouble. And that's when we realised that the trouble was down to us. We were responsible for these beautiful veteran oaks falling sick and becoming very staggy and, you know, shortening their lives. So that's what started us along the whole journey of rewilding in the first place, I suppose. But what's interesting is that I think we've come full circle because in the absence of thorny scrub, the oak doesn't have any way of regenerating, really, except for human planting. So there's been very little of that over the last few centuries in Britain. In medieval times, though, there's this wonderful adage they have in the New Forest, which is the thorn is the mother of the oak. And there's this recognition that jays will plant the acorns right next to a little patch of thorny scrub. It's probably for the jay, it's a marker of where to remember that that acorn is so it can feed the cotyledons to its young the following year. But what happens quite often is that thorny scrub encroaches around that sapling as it grows and provides a kind of natural barbed wire. So it's a natural defence against grazing by roe deer or whatever else is in the landscape. And that's how oak trees naturally regenerate in an open landscape. They need light, these trees, oak trees. So they never would have thrived in closed canopy forest, which is what we often have in our heads used to exist before human impact. They would always have needed open areas to produce acorns. And so the oak really is the evidence that we have, beyond anything else, that our landscape would have been much, much more open than previously imagined.
Right. The mental acrobatics that you describe that all of these proponents, I guess, of the closed canopy theory go through to explain how oak trees survived or how, you know, lichens ended up where they are was just astonishing to me. And I wanted you to talk about, I guess, why there's such a resistance to rewilding, why this idea is so controversial and why there were so many hurdles to your project, both administrative and legal, but also, you know, socially. Your neighbors were not really happy initially, right?
I think it's sort of easy to understand, actually. I think if you were a neighbour of ours and you're used to looking out on a landscape that you feel is very stable and very secure, hedged fields, everything manicured within an inch of its life, linear edges to woods and copses, rivers that are managed so that they never burst their banks, and you know, if you've got that sense of control, this very Victorian corseted obsession with control in your culture, which we do, I think, certainly in Britain we do, then you're looking over your garden fence and you see that landscape changing into thorny scrub, creeping thistle, ragwort, and certainly for the first few years, not much to show for it. Then you think, what on earth are they doing? We got so many letters of complaint and letters that we were being at best kind of negligent or irresponsible. At worst, we were being unpatriotic because we weren't growing food. We were being irresponsible and destroying the beauty of the countryside. And we just had to stick to our guns then, I think, because we knew why we were doing it and we just felt that exciting things were happening. We were already seeing orchids coming back in the middle of the field, so we knew that there was mycorrhizal networks beginning to re-establish in our very depleted soils. we were seeing fantastic insects coming back. Already, I think we were seeing purple emperor butterflies within a few years of the project, one of our rarest butterflies. And we'd started to hear turtle doves and nightingales by about 2007. So we knew that something exciting was happening. And I think now things are changing because now we have got these astonishing wildlife successes. I think people are much more understanding of what we're doing and much more tolerant. And I think it's helped to change really the aesthetic because it's beautiful, but in a very different way. And we now get thousands of people a year coming to visit us to see NEP and to walk in it and to hear this amazing surround sound birdsong. And that, I think, is beginning to change people's values and people's way of looking at the countryside and what it could be and what it was perhaps in the past and what it could be in the future.
We'll be back in a minute with the story of how Isabella and her husband, Charlie, dealt with an explosion of creeping thistle at NEP. In the meantime, turtle doves, and a word from our sponsors. So speaking of creeping thistle, I think that sort of exemplifies the transition from, you know, a negligent landscape to something beautiful and just how complex the ecosystem is, because that was so unpredictable what happened.
Yes, oh, that was rather terrifying. I mean, you know, it's been quite a journey for us, I think, having been control freaks ourselves, having been farmers, you know. And a few years into the project, we suddenly saw creeping thistle, you know, just completely explode. It's a very successful pioneer plant. So it comes in at any opportunity. And as any gardener knows, trying to dig it up, you know, its roots go incredibly deep and it will just explode again. So as farmers, if you see creeping thistle, you're out there instantly with the toppers and the herbicides. And we had taken this sort of journey into rewilding where we were really giving nature the driving seat. So we had to sit on our hands and watch this creeping thistle cover acres and acres and acres and think, what on earth are we going to do about this? And what was astonishing was 2 years on, we suddenly had this explosion of painted lady butterflies. It happened to coincide with this incredible migration, a boom year for painted lady butterflies, which had migrated from Morocco, and they'd come to Britain in their many, many millions. And literally, we woke up one morning, one summer morning, and these butterflies were flying past our window like tracer. It was absolutely extraordinary. And you could stand in the creeping thistle because this was where they were landing. It's their food plant. And so they would lay their eggs and the caterpillars over that summer, just destroyed the creeping thistle. And the following year, there wasn't a plant left. So it was our first lesson in the kind of boom and bust cycles of nature. Nature doesn't really tolerate a monoculture for long. Something will come in and take advantage of it. You've just got to be patient and let nature take its course, and then you see these extraordinary miracles happening. So we now, when we see creeping thistle or ragwort exploding in sort of beautiful billows of yellow across the landscape, we just hold our nerve and think, no, it's okay.
So speaking of surprising arrivals, one of the other incredible sections in your book involved the arrival of the purple emperor butterfly and other species like nightingales and turtle doves. But as you write, if you had been trying to build the perfect park for purple emperors and turtle doves or whatever, you wouldn't have been nearly as successful as you were accidentally.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It's so interesting because what's happened at NEP is this habitat has reemerged because of the free roaming animals that it would have been very much like the landscape, say, in medieval times, the times when scrubland and thorny scrub was very much treasured. And we only have to go back into our old place names of our fields to know that they were once scrub. You know, they're called Fursfield and Brummer's Corner and all these old English names that point to kind of different types of scrub. So what all these species are finding at NEP is a habitat that's not out there in the landscape anymore. But because we have been observing these creatures like turtle doves and nightingales and purple emperors in our depleted landscape for the last 50 years, we assume that where we see them is where they want to be. So nightingales and purple emperor butterflies, for example, are classed in all the guidebooks as woodland species because that's the only place that you see them now, is in woodland. But at NEP, we're not finding them in woodland at all. We're finding them right out in the open in this emerging scrub. And that is where they are absolutely thriving. And so really, it's teaching us that species aren't necessarily where we allocate them. It's just that that's where we're seeing them nowadays. That species may be clinging on by their fingernails to habitat that's not optimum for them. But they would much prefer something like NEP. So we're sort of rewriting the science texts in a way, and we're reminding ourselves of where these species originated and where they would much, much rather be. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are other examples, too, that you talk about. We haven't really talked about water yet, and that's a huge component of the landscape at NEP, you know, the river and rewilding the waterways. And it seems like efforts in communities like this little town in the Yorkshire Dales, Pickering, that you talk about, it was nearly washed away by flooding, and then it survived a flood later in 2015, essentially after they built a man-made beaver dam.
Yes.
and that's sort of, that like to me really tells the story of what's wrong with our conventional approach to water management. So what does a rewilding approach to water look like?
Well, I mean, I think it's not a huge area at NEP. We've got this tiny river that was canalized in the Victorian times, really to get the water off the land and make it better for agriculture, which it sort of seemed to fail to do because our clay loves to hold the water. We wanted to renaturalize the river. So we wanted to push it out of its canal, get it back onto the floodplain, get back into the meanders where it used to be. And it took us about 8 years trying to persuade the Environment Agency. It was 8 years of the most frustrating time. But finally, they agreed to fund it. And then for 2 years, we had Reg, the digger driver, creating another kind of canal, just a wiggly canal. He could not mess it up. He couldn't make the edges messy. He couldn't make it shallow. He couldn't think like a beaver. And so after Reg had gone, we simply went in there and did a pickering job. I mean, we went in there and created woody debris blockages like beavers would have done. We tried to slow the water down a bit. We tried to create eddies and riffles and mess up the margins using the cattle to kind of open it up a little bit, shallow it out. But we realised after all this effort that we had been doing something that a pair of beavers could have done in half the time at no expense and much, much better. So we are now going to be applying for a license to release beaver at NEP. We'll see how that goes down. But I think the signs are good at last. I think the British government are seeing that the beaver has huge positives for the landscape and for hydrology and biodiversity. And it's thanks largely to all the studies done in America showing how beavers in America have restored ecosystems and what they do for water purification and fish populations, everything. And of course, there's amazing studies in Europe where the beaver has also been bouncing back and is now present in the many millions. It just takes us much longer, I think, than anywhere else to realise and go for change. We're very fearful of change being an island, I think.
So, I mean, speaking of beaver licenses, which is a really charming concept, supposing that you could do whatever you wanted on the estate and that there were no hurdles like this and you could just drop some beavers in there tomorrow, what does your dream NEP have in the future that it doesn't have already now?
Well, it's so interesting doing a rewilding project because really, it has no goals, it has no targets. So we don't hope for anything really except that, you know, just to see what will happen. And year on year, we just have more and more species returning. So we expect that will just continue building because it seems like, you know, E.O. Wilson describes that the more life there is, the more life there is. So I think we're anticipating just more adventures of the same, you know, more exciting species returning. I think one thing we would love, as I said, we'd love the beaver back. We'd also love to connect our land with neighbours. We're already talking to some of our neighbours now who are sounding like they're interested. we'd one day love to connect with the sea. It's only about 25 miles away as the crow flies, or the nightingale or the turtle dove flies. And we'd love it, you know, to have our cattle browsing on sallow at Knepp 1 week, and then grazing on seaweed on the pebble beach at Shoreham the next. That to us would be truly landscape scale. And then maybe we could think about reintroducing bison, perhaps, you know, something that's a really heavy hitter that can really do battle with some vegetation and create some more wonderful habitat for us. But again, I think we have to change our mentality, and I think public perception, we hope, will evolve to appreciate what free-roaming animals can do, so that we can learn to live with wild horses again, carcasses rotting down in the countryside without being tidied up all the time, because obviously you're depriving a whole host of kind of decaying species that specialise in decaying and rotting bodies. And that's all part of the process of soil restoration and all that. We're really missing a trick there with us tidying up carcasses on the land. So we'd like to see that. We'd like to see, I think, just an appreciation for the dynamism that can be back in a landscape again, and for people to feel less fearful of natural processes.
We have photographs of the incredible biodiversity at Knepp on our episode page, as well as wildlife videos and links to more about Knepp and Frans Vira's work in the Oostvaardersplasse, also known as the Dutch Serengeti. Assuming I don't start rewilding on my own, we'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.